It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Two federal judges, two very different opinions about the NSA's controversial bulk metadata collection program coming 2 weeks apart. Recently, Judge Richard Leon ruled in Washington, D.C. that the program likely violated the law, while Judge William Pauley ruled in New York that the program did not violate the law. How did these two judges arrive at different conclusions? And is this case headed for the Supreme Court? I'm joined now in Studio A by our legal expert, David Harris, distinguished faculty scholar and professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. David, Happy New Year. Good to see you.
Paul, Happy New Year to you, and it's good to be back.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Do you feel that the NSA's controversial bulk metadata collection program is constitutional? What are your opinions? What are your concerns and questions? Our email address, ESSPGH at WESA.FM. You can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at hashtag EPLive. And again, the number 412-246-2002. David, how did these two federal judges arrive at such starkly different conclusions?
Well, Paul, they are equal in the sense that they're both federal trial judges, one in Washington, one in New York. Presented with the same case, we have radically different opinions, really just mirror images of each other because of the outlooks of each judge on questions of the Fourth Amendment and privacy. One judge taking a very much 9/11 sort of view. This is Judge Pauley in New York, actually beginning his opinion with anecdotes from the 9/11 terrorist attack, saying, here's what happened, some calls were intercepted, and if there had been an NSA program like this one in place, we might have stopped the attacks. And that is sort of the fountain point of all of his reasoning, that this is a program, it works, it prevents damage, and so forth. Judge Leon in Washington, D.C., has a really different worldview. He's of the view that, you know, technology has gotten so powerful and has advanced so much that it's time to rethink some of our basic Fourth Amendment assumptions that have been in place for some decades, and that the collection of all of this data, every phone call in the United States, the dialing and contact information, the so-called metadata, that is just a bridge too far, and it's time to rethink where we are and take stock and stop it.
And you mentioned the Fourth Amendment, which protects people against unreasonable searches and seizures by the government. What do these cases and the NSA program have to do with the Fourth Amendment? How does it come into play here?
Well, the Fourth Amendment says that the people shall not have to endure unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, that's obviously an elastic term, and courts from time out of mind, including and especially the Supreme Court, have had the job of giving content to what does reasonable or unreasonable mean. In 1979, the Supreme Court had a case called Smith versus Maryland, and there are some real basic similarities. I mean, the technology was so different. We were all still using, or most of us were still using, dial phones. Now, if you remember, when you picked up a dial phone and you dialed a number, you'd hear in your ear, click, 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 click. Mm-hmm. And the number of clicks would tell you which hole you'd put your finger in to dial. Five clicks, you'd dial to five. And so there were the devices called pen registers. The pen register would count the number of clicks, so you'd get essentially a record of who was being called from that phone. The question in Smith versus Maryland was whether the government needed a warrant to use a pen register, whether that was an unreasonable search or seizure. And the court in Smith versus Maryland said, look, the person dialing that number has essentially given that information to a third party, the third party being a phone company, for purposes of connecting that call. And when you give information to a third party, you lose your expectation that that information is going to be private. Your reasonable expectation of privacy in your number you dialed is gone because you gave it to the phone company.
So if I'm on the phone with somebody that's asking me for my Social Security number, I better assume that even though they may tell me that we're not going to give this to anybody else, that any information, that Social Security number or anything else, could end up in somebody else's hands.
You've got to be careful with your social. And you give it to a third party, you are potentially compromising it. Now, it's a very different thing to say I gave it to the phone company for purposes of connecting my call, to it's very different than saying, well, that means the government can have it. I mean, those are two different things. That's always been my problem with Smith versus Maryland. It should not be the case that just because you give information to a third party, the government can get it without a warrant or without any evidence
but
at
that
all.
Is in fact
but that is what it says.
Right.
And I think that that was a bad case when it was decided. And now, with the technological advances we have seen since 1979, cell phones, internet, you name it, it simply makes no sense. You cannot live the world in the world we live in now, the digital world, without transmitting information all over the place to third parties. And so that decision effectively leaves everything we do in the digital world wide open, not just to the third parties, but to the government. It's a bad decision, but it still stands.
Well, it's fascinating how it all evolves because you have the Constitution, which was written in the 18th century.
Absolutely.
Which could not even imagine things like telephones, let alone all the things that we have today.
Yes.
And I want to get into some of that, but I do also want to work in some calls at 412-246-2002. So let's go to Beverly from Shadyside, who wants to join the conversation with David Harris. Beverly, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, thank you for having me on, sir. I actually am a veteran in the Air Force, and I've noticed that in my personal experience with connecting the dots, as you will, the system, the governmental system, is a draconian system. It has yet to catch up with the third-party, private parties that are working with the government. So the bureaucratic red tape that's involved is immense. So what my input is, this is only the tip of the iceberg, that the Snowden, what he's done, is just one person, one whistleblower, and he's uncovered this massive amount of information for the public to know and realize. What about the NSA domestic drone issues? What about all the other issues that they're not telling the public currently? Thank you.
Well, and thank you, Beverly, for the phone call. And David, you know, really, you're an expert on the law and the Constitution. So we're talking about technology, drones. I don't know where that it's a part of it's something that the government can use to monitor things, maybe even conversations that people are having within the United States. So this is taking the technology one step further. And with each development, you have to decide, is a warrant needed for this, correct?
Well, that's absolutely right. And the down and dirty, Paul, is that the law always runs behind technological innovation. And this was true in the 60s when the first wiretap laws went on the books.
When they went on the books?
Yes. Before that, there was – I mean, clearly the Constitution made wiretapping without a warrant illegal. But lots of places, lots of states, cities ignored it.
Well, you go back to if you watch Elliot Ness and the Untouchables, they show those guys –
wiretapping all the time.
All the time. So what happened back then when obviously, the framers of the Constitution could not have anticipated phones coming into play. So how was it handled from a legal standpoint?
Well, in the 20s, very few people knew about it, and only the FBI and some other law enforcement units were able to do it. So it became widespread but not widely known, and the technology was primitive. It only was in the 60s that this became a widespread thing, that in the 50s and then into the 60s, it was used against so-called subversives. And there was a lot of overstepping by the government and intelligence agencies. And in the 60s, finally, you have a reaction. Hey, wait a minute. This is just going too far. And in the 70s, we get into the hearings by the church committees and things that showed a lot of domestic surveillance. And people became very conscious of that in the 60s. That's when you had the federal government pass a law that regulated wiretapping even more strongly than the Fourth Amendment would. And many states have their own wiretapping laws, including Pennsylvania, including lots of other places. And it's because it became part of the public concern and consciousness that the legislative bodies kind of get up on their hind legs and start to do something. We are in a similar moment now in the last few years with technology really kind of outstripping anything the law had thought about before. We've got the GPS case that came to the Supreme Court in 2012. We've got the NSA revelations. Now, I think what we're having is a conversation about our privacy rights. Do we still have any? Where are we going with this? And what are we willing to accept?
We had General Michael Hayden on this program recently. He's the former head of both the CIA and the NSA. And he defended the NSA's metadata collection program, as you might expect. And he says it comes down to what is reasonable. And he said it in a way that seemed to indicate that, you know, it's loosely defined enough so that it can always be in play, and in this case, interpreted differently by two different federal judges.
Yes, absolutely. Well, General Hayden is not wrong when he says the key thing is whether it's reasonable, and there's enough law in the books that says it is reasonable through a series of interpretations that at this point, I don't think legally he's wrong. Smith versus Maryland, that the Penn Register case, is enough to underpin his assertion that it is reasonable to collect the calling in and out data, the so-called metadata. However, this program of the NSA's goes, you know, it does it for everybody all the time, all at once. That's a far cry from counting the clicks on one phone. So while he's not wrong, we've certainly had enough change in the capability of the technology that it seems like it might be time to revisit it. When you have a standard like reasonable or unreasonable, it is always going to be subject to interpretation. And to have our courts interpret that, that's what we've been doing. The problem is courts run behind. Courts look at things that have happened before. Whereas,
for example, 1979, right. We're talking well over 35 years ago.
Well, even now with these cases challenging what the NSA is doing now, they're actually based on what it did 2 years and 3 years ago. So it would be better to think now, well, what kind of a world do we want? What do we want our intelligence agencies doing, and to make laws about that instead of having the courts react to it? Because this is, in a way, this is our decision. We the people. We have a right to make laws that say, no, NSA. That the Supreme Court may even approve this and say it's reasonable. But for us, we don't want to live in a society like that. So these are very, very important questions we should be asking. And whatever conclusion we come to, we shouldn't be afraid to act.
We're talking about the NSA's controversial bulk metadata collection program, the two recent different rulings from two different federal judges. Our guest is legal expert, distinguished faculty scholar, and professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, David Harris. 412-246-2002 is our number, and Chris in Moon is on the phone. Chris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes. Yeah, hi there, and hello, Professor Harris. You were right on the money with that comment, by the way, about being proactive. In a way, the whole issue of pen registers is, in fact, the whole law in the reaction is being set up to react to that, whether or not for the data or not, when, in fact, the technology is so far beyond that, from RFIDs to nanotech-based tracking devices, which they can inject in people. I mean, all this stuff is beyond it. And the one interesting thing that's come out of this whole is the President's Privacy Commission, which is headed up by, some of the prominent members include, well, Richard Clark, you know, who a lot of folks know. Now, I read that thing cover to cover, and it's not doing it. You know, basically, it's missing all this stuff. One of the recommendations, number five, is, in fact, that it's over to a private party, without defining who that is, some sort of this massive database that has been developed. Anyway, I want to find out if you read it and what your thoughts are, if you have, and also in terms of being proactive, just to sort of expand upon this. I mean, because really, this is what's required. The courts are reacting, and they're not doing it. It's
right,
just
right.
Not happening.
Well,
let me
thank you, Chris. And have you, in fact, read it? What about what Chris is asking you?
I have not read the full report as Chris has. I have read some of the summaries and excerpts. The thing that was interesting about the President's Privacy Commission is that it came at almost the same time. It came out, I should say, at almost the same time as these two different, very different court opinions. And it sort of takes a middle way between them. It doesn't quite say the program is illegal under the Constitution, should be dumped. It certainly doesn't say it should be continued in its current form. So it's a more pragmatic view on the one hand. On the other, it doesn't accept everything that the government has said or alleged. So it's one committee's take on this, and Congress should take that as a starting point, not an ending point, and begin the discussion and come up with some real rules about what can be done. That's what we elect those people for. They should reflect our values and our privacy standards and put them into law. They don't have to wait for courts to do it.
Well, here's one concern that people have. And Beverly, our earlier caller, alluded to this about when she said that Edward Snowden has divulged is really just the tip of the iceberg. But it also speaks to what somebody who has access to this data can do. The recent report on the NSA by the President's Review Group on Intelligence and Communications Technologies points out that an NSA employee with a grudge against someone can look up that person's phone number, look through the metadata for evidence that he dials up Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, or a suicide hotline, and then blackmail or harass him. So how much of a safety net is there to protect people against that kind of concern?
I think that's a real concern, Paul, but frankly, I think it pales by comparison to what a person in Snowden's position was able to accomplish. I mean, if a person at the NSA chooses to abuse a person that they're having a bad time with, that's very serious, but it's only those two people who are involved. Snowden, I mean, he's caused the national conversation to be had, but he had access as a systems administrator to almost anything you could imagine. And he has put not only enough to start the conversation out in public, he's put far more than that out in public. And it shows that when you have somebody who's got access to a full network of these things in order to connect the dots, if you're not careful, if you outsource, if you get these contractors involved, if there's not a lot of care and a lot of control, one person like Snowden can put out countless documents that can really do damage, as much as he's done some good things too.
Let's go to Stephen Duquesne, who has an excellent question. Steve, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul. Professor Harris, my question is simply this. When probable cause is referenced in the Fourth Amendment, my take on it has always been that that requires something tangible. General Hayden's interpretation of that is reasonable suspicion. And I think there's a distinction. That sounds more like a hunch. Could you amplify on whether there actually is a distinction? And if so, how we got from one point to the other by law?
Sure.
Great question, Steve. And so, David, can we make a distinction between probable cause and reasonable suspicion?
Yes. Probable cause is the traditional Fourth Amendment standard. It's even said in the Fourth Amendment that that's the standard for getting warrants. That is a quantum of evidence. It doesn't have to be any particular kind. It can be in the form of testimony or information or objects or any other thing. Enough evidence to show a probability. No more, just a probability that a crime has been committed or somebody's up to no good and that the person specified is involved. It's not proof positive. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It isn't even more probable than not, sort of 50.1%. It's less. Reasonable suspicion came into the legal lexicon in a case called Terry versus Ohio, which a lot of your listeners will recognize as the stop and frisk case. Reasonable suspicion is a lower standard than probable cause. So if probable cause is less than half by some large degree, reasonable suspicion is even less. It simply means that it can't be a hunch. It has to be more than a hunch, more than a gut instinct. There has to be some suspicion founded upon reason, some fact-based suspicion that the agent or police officer can articulate, could tell a judge, not just that guy looks dirty or something wrong with that, but he has looks like a bulge under the coat. That might be an illegal gun. Therefore, I'm going to go after it. So they are distinct standards, and if you want to get a warrant, you still need probable cause. Other types of more temporary actions, such as stop and frisk, can be done just on reasonable suspicion.
Is the NSA's metadata collection program, in your opinion, David, is it constitutional?
I think it's debatable. I mean, I know that's a little bit of a cop-out, but I think that's the only reasonable position there is. Under the law as it exists, with Smith versus Maryland, it is enough like a pen register that the side, the government that is, that wants to uphold the program can say, look, it's third-party data. All of that is fair game. On the other hand, technology has changed so radically that we had our Supreme Court decide just 1.5 years ago that you can't place a GPS device underneath a car to track it, that there was something wrong with that. You needed a warrant, and you had at least two justices saying in that opinion, we got to rethink this third party stuff. So I think the time has come to have that argument.
It's headed for the Supreme Court?
Well, it could. If the Congress changes the law, no. If the two appeals courts that are going to get these two opinions out of the trial courts, if they agree with each other and they say uphold the program, probably not. But if they're in disagreement and if the Congress does nothing, the Supreme Court may very well step in and give us an answer.
David Harris is distinguished faculty scholar and professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. David, as always, great thanks.
It was my pleasure, Paul. Good to be with you.
Coming up, we'll discuss a recent report criticizing the Pittsburgh Police side jobs policy. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.